This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we have three people talking about community choice aggregation and what's going on in various parts of the country. Our first person discussing it will be Rick Brown at Terra Verde Energy in California. So, Rick, why don't you go ahead and start us out?
Yeah, so good morning, everyone. I'm going to start with just some basics about where the CCA movement is in California. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that because I'm assuming that most people have a general idea, but what I will spend some time on is some of the work that we're doing to support CCAs, particularly around their integrating customer programs to help them with their procurement strategies and their cost structures. So hopefully that's of interest to folks, and I'll spend a little time on that. But in terms of the basics, at last count, I think we have now 19 CCAs in California. We have another dozen or so who are hoping to launch in the next year or so. But we're on a pathway that by the mid-20s, there's projections that somewhere close to 80% of customers, 80% of load that previously was served by the three major investor-owned utilities in California will be served by a CCA. So it's a pretty amazing and rapid transformation in terms of how electricity is being procured and sold to customers. Now, again, another basic, CCAs have nothing to do with the wires and poles. The delivery system, so to speak, they are in the business of procuring electricity or generating electricity and selling it to customers. And they're organized as governmental entities, usually in the form of a joint powers authority amongst a number of different jurisdictions. But there are some cases where there's a single jurisdiction, a single city that is the entity that governs the CCA. So that's sort of as far as I'm going to go on the basics. The other important news to hear is that just I think it was Monday, if not yesterday, the second CCA in California obtained a investment grade credit rating. The first one to get an investment grade credit rating was MCE Clean Energy, which was actually the, so to speak, first CCA in California, and currently covers the counties of Marin, Napa, Contra Costa, and I believe all of Solano now. So it's a growing CCA. They obtained a credit rating a year and a half or so ago. The second CCA to get a credit rating, investment credit rating, was Peninsula Clean Energy, which serves San Mateo County. The county that's just south of San Francisco, and the southern portion of which is, covering a number of what's known as Silicon Valley area, although there's another CCA that covers another part of the Silicon Valley area. So that's an important development because what it suggests is that the credit markets are starting to recognize that these entities are growing up and are getting to a place where they can access capital in more cost-efficient, cost-effective ways. This is important because in California right now, we have a lot of questions about the creditworthiness of our energy providers. As many of you may know, PG&E, the largest investor-owned utility, has filed for bankruptcy. But the other two major IOUs, their credit ratings have dropped. This is primarily a function not of their procurement of electricity, but more the liabilities and risks associated with them being the owners operators of the transmission and distribution network, which is being looked at as the cause, or actually has been proven to be the cause of some of the recent major wildfires in California. So the fact that one of the arguments has traditionally been that CCAs, are risky because they don't have a credit rating, so their ability to meet the requirements of being able to access capital to cost-effectively procure and have energy available, that's starting to change. And so important development there. I'm interested in Sam's comments on that also. In terms of what we're working on right now, I actually am sitting in a parking lot in L.A. Waiting for a meeting with a single city CCA, where I'm going to be meeting with a local school district in that CCA territory and describing to them a program model where they would partner with the local CCA to install solar and batteries at the school district, both for their own use in terms of offsetting their electricity costs, but also through a partnership with their CCA to provide those batteries essentially as part of a virtual power plant to allow the CCA to impact some of its costs of procurement through load shifting, through various revenue generating opportunities and so forth. This is not the first such opportunity that we're working on. We're working with a couple other CCAs on developing similar kinds of programs. And this work, and then we're all working with another couple CCAs, including MCE, the first one that I mentioned earlier, on a program of a similar type where we would help them incentivize customers who are net metering customers, who have solar and have net metering, to incentivize those customers to install batteries and be able to both use those batteries to absorb surplus production that's come from some of those systems where the CCA is basically on the hook of paying for that surplus production but not really getting a whole lot of benefit out of it, and instead being able to store that energy in batteries that, again, then can be used by both the customer for their own benefit but also, as I mentioned, as part of a virtual power plant to help the CCA with their own procurement costs and procurement needs and generating revenues. That project is an outgrowth of a research project that we're doing in partnership with MC under a grant from the California Energy Commission. The first one that I mentioned, the CCA where we're working on the VPP, is an outgrowth of a research grant that we're doing under a National Renewable Energy Lab project. So that's sort of the high level.
Okay. Just lost you. Rick, are you still there? Can you hear me? All right, we lost Rick. So, Samuel, why don't you go ahead and dive
sure.
in here.
Yeah, tag team on California. okay, so to put some broader framing around what Rick was describing, I like to portray the California CCA industry as evolving through a couple of maturity models, Community Choice 2.0, which is an operational model with specific features, and then 3.0, which is a focus on joint action. It's a governance model, and it culminates in, so it's CCAs working together to share resources and, you know, contracting and developing for shared services, and it culminates in the establishment of a kind of a centralized agency, which is more of a vehicle for collaboration across all the staff, and the provision of a technical platform, a technology data analytics platform.
Samuel, I'd like to do one thing first. We kind of dove in the middle of this. I'd like to introduce you. Samuel Golding with Community Choice Partners in California. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, thanks, Sarah. So I've been a CCA consultant for about a decade now. And the reason, so the significance of those maturity models is that it's going to lead to, and it's designed to lead to, very systemic changes, reforms in the California market. Because the way that we've constructed our operating models, it has been in a very transparent fashion, where we look at all the business requirements of operating a competitive power agency, and then we source the necessary services from different vendors while also staffing up internally And so we've got, you know, about 200 staff hired at present across all the agencies and increasingly very substantial expertise with CEOs and senior staff exercising oversight and guiding the evolution of these agencies. The significance of that is profound because California has never really had, you know, this synthesis of political authority to pursue reforms, right, and a collaborative local political culture that expects to, you know, pursue reforms, and the technical, the kind of frontline operational expertise to know what needs to be changed in a holistic fashion. And so now that we've kind of gotten a scale and these various agencies are working together, I expect that we'll enter into a very interesting phase of evolution where we get out of focusing on, you know, a lot of the media coverage has been on viewing these CCAs individually, viewing them as businesses, right? And that's important, but it misses the fact that the greater opportunity here is to really create the governance that is required to achieve multi-sectoral decarbonization in practice. Because, you know, if you think about it, that's going to necessarily be a very local process. It, you know, you're talking about decarbonizing across multiple sectors, buildings, transportation, electricity, natural gas, and those, you know, the rubber meets the road really at the city, the community, the city, and the regional economy level. And so municipal governments have a range of authorities that are necessary for that transformation, like building codes, land use, transportation planning. They're used to coordinating together for regional planning already. And they're politically, their culture, you know, they're very used to involving all of their community stakeholders in their decision-making processes. And that is something that state regulatory commissions lack, all of those characteristics and authorities that are vital for actually figuring out how to decarbonize rapidly in practice. And we're already starting to see the benefits of this. So I sent out an email with a lot of links to, you know, the various breakthroughs that CCAs in California are setting in motion. And they are starting to create multi-sectoral decarbonization plans. They're planning, you know, REACH codes to target fossil fuel and programs for fuel switching. There's going to be a very large expansion of electric vehicle chargers, and they've started to work. One of them has rolled out a technology platform, a data platform that all CCAs have been invited to use for smart meter data, load forecasting, you know, reporting, distributed energy program design, and that sort of thing. And if we, that's kind of one step along the route to putting in place the technology platform and reforms necessary to collapse all the silos that have been imposed across the power sector that have really held us back. Because, you know, from an operational perspective, the way that we plan and manage the power markets, utility portfolios in terms of risk management, the low and high voltage networks, the distribution and the transmission grid, the planning and operations there, the way that we structure retail rates and pass price signals to customers, and the way that we allow or don't allow distributed energy aggregators to integrate into all those different dimensions, that is very siloed. And so it prevents us from really fully monetizing all of the opportunities that we could and really accelerating the integration of distributed energy. So that's my high-level view of what's going on. I think we're entering into a very compelling phase of evolution that should start turning a lot of heads. And I sent out a very long email with a lot of links to specific initiatives in that context.
All right. And I forwarded that to everybody just about the time this started, so it's probably in your inbox right now. So, Peter, do you have anything to add about what's happening in Connecticut? Peter Millman from People's Action for Clean Energy.
Yeah. First of all, I come to this as a novice, very much a novice compared to what Samuel and Rick have been doing. I've been in, very much focused on CCA for probably less than a year. And so I come to this call more as a student than as a any kind of a teacher. Having said that, I have tended to focus on California and Massachusetts as the two states that Connecticut can learn the most from. So Connecticut is a state that did deregulate, so the utilities cannot own generation facilities. And it already has the opportunity for individuals to choose third-party suppliers, but it does not have any enabling legislation for community choice. The three states that surround us, New York, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, all do have community choice of one sort or another. I look to California as what community choice can be, and I look to Massachusetts as a state that we can learn a lot from, some of which is what we should be, what we should be aspiring to, particularly when I look at Cape Light Compact, which is the only multi-jurisdictional CCA in that state. But then I look at the rest of the state and say they have not really evolved very far past being CCA 1.0 as buying cooperatives. And some of the towns have, and their CCAs have, gotten some pretty good deals in lowering cost and increasing renewable energy content and doing it with, in some cases, high-quality RECs. But they haven't gone much beyond that. I think that Connecticut has some of the same obstacles that Massachusetts faces, which is that we don't have a strong county system. We don't have much of a tradition of regionalism. And so unlike California, which I think has both, it's going to be tough to get Connecticut towns to work together, which can, leads to more ambitious versions of CCA. So as far as what's going on here, I've been working on with a couple of other people putting together, first of all, a coalition, mostly at this point of environmental groups to back the idea. I have about 7 or 8 groups now and more in the coming. And then this past session, or the current session, 2019 session of the legislature here, there were two skeleton or spot bills introduced. I don't think that the legislators, and this is not a criticism of them, but I think that they did it as a favor to, in one case to me and in another case to somebody else. They introduced the bills because there really has been remarkably little consciousness of community choice in Connecticut among legislators, among town officials, among clean energy advocates and environmental groups. So what's coming up for this year, so nothing really happened. Those bills were not voted out of committee. And what we see the coming year being is a year of building awareness of CCA and also political support. Part of that will be through trying to pass municipal resolutions, which I'll be distributing shortly to various groups and towns where I have contacts. And that will serve two purposes, of course. One will be by having to consider the resolutions, it will start the educational process for both town officials energy advocates and environmental groups, but it'll also begin to send a political message to state legislators that there is support for this. And I'll stop in just a second, but one of the people who I'm working with was kind enough to tack on a polling question about CCAs onto a larger poll that he conducted for another client. And the results were that 75% of Connecticut, of the 600 Connecticut residents that were contacted, voiced support or strong support for the idea of CCA. So the long and the short of it is Connecticut has a long way to go before it reaches where Massachusetts is and New York, let alone California.
All right. So any comments about this? Questions?
Well, this is Rick. Can you hear me?
Sure. We're good.
Yeah. The only thing I would say to Peter is, you know, hang in there. This is a marathon, not a sprint. I mean, in California, it was the California energy crisis in the early 2000s that finally got things moving such that we now have, you know, we got legislation that enabled CCAs, and that was, you know, that was sort of, I think, 8 or 9 years between the crisis and when the first CCA was formed. And in between, the IOUs funded a multi-million dollar campaign to get a state proposition passed that would have blocked CCAs from going forward. So as much as you can, you know, look at us and go, oh, look how wonderful things in California, it was a slog to get there. And you may have, you know, I hate to say it, but it may be a crisis in your own community, in your own jurisdiction, that may, you know, that you'll have to take advantage of in order to you know, get that movement going. But hang in there.
Point taken, and I appreciate it.
Hopefully it's a lower bar. They're already restructured, and their utilities aren't quite as, you know, they don't behave like Pacific Gas Electric did under Darby,
yeah.
I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And the other thing I'd say is that, you know, Connecticut and all the states that are considering enabling legislation, I think there were five this year that put forward legislation, they can really learn from kind of what we've uncovered, kind of the cutting edge of the practices in California, because there's certain things that should be in the enabling legislation from the get-go so that you can avoid the same pitfalls and kind of leapfrog in deploying best practices. And that's actually, that's a key concern of mine, is that a lot of states' legislation seem to be repeating, you know, kind of based on templates that are 10 or 20 years outdated, in my opinion. I like New Hampshire's legislation quite a lot, actually. It's drafted by a former commissioner in the state who really understands the system and the architecture and kind of where the value creation potential lies. And he's very focused on, he's produced some credible analyses on the value that could be created by aligning the utility's smart metering data infrastructure with wholesale risk management. And so what that means is, you know, simple example, if you have a smart thermostat and you have the ability to, you know, turn it off for 15 minutes or delay it for 15 minutes while prices are spiking in that interval in the wholesale markets, you can end up saving quite a lot of money and lowering the risk for the entire aggregation if you carry those activities out systematically. And that, so he's approaching this already from kind of the lens that California is now viewing, you know, after evolving for a decade. And that's the sort of leapfrog perspective I'd like to see throughout these states.
What other pitfalls or specific kinds of inclusions do you think would you like to see the newer state, the states considering this include in their legislation?
Well, to go just briefly a little deeper on the previous subject, you know, there has to be a focus on data access, at least the AMI infrastructure, the smart meter data, the customer data, and that should be drafted by someone who is very knowledgeable about the state's utilities and the market there, to be, you know, to include all the right enabling authorities. I would like to see an expansion there where CCAs in new states are more closely integrated with utility distribution system operations from the get-go. CCAs in California, incidentally, are starting to work with our utilities because we've all realized that if we're going to massively expand distributed energy in a coordinated fashion, that has to be incorporated into distribution grid planning and operations. It's a physical necessity. So there's data streams like this, you know, the SCADA, the real-time monitoring from those platforms that CCAs could have access to, that would enhance their retail and their wholesale operations and risk management functions. Another feature would be the, you know, some states actually hard code into their legislation that CCA has to outsource everything to a retailer. So, you know, there's basically no ability to evolve the CCA or to facilitate the transfer of expert knowledge to the local level that's required to really use the CCA to pursue reforms in that model. That's been one of the primary barriers in the other states for using CCA for multi-sectoral decarbonization. And so the trick there is that the CCA has to be allowed to structure its own portfolio of wholesale products. So instead of just getting a fixed price for a year or 3 years from a retailer, the CCA goes out and they hire a service provider. There's public and private entities that will do all the forecasting, the risk management, and will negotiate with a variety of suppliers to structure a flexible book of contracts to supply the aggregation and to manage, predict, and manage the residual market price exposure from that portfolio. So it's, you know, a key element of commodity risk management. It's at the core of the business model, and that knowledge should be managed transparently. So the first CCA to do that in California really was Redwood Coast. They brought in a nonprofit entity called the Energy Authority. And even though this CCA and that nonprofit was owned by municipal utilities, so even though that CCA only had 60,000 accounts, it's up in Humboldt County, it's pretty small, they formed a risk committee. They started producing all these sophisticated analytics. They adopted what I would consider an industry standard risk management policy with, you know, matrices of position limits and triggers and delegation of authority and oversight and all the rest, controls. And they structured a book of 20 transactions from a dozen suppliers. And Rick mentioned that Peninsula just got a credit rating. Well, if you read Moody's news release on that, you'll note that one of the key factors that Moody's cites is that Peninsula is managing a diversified portfolio of contracts where no supplier is giving them more than 15% of their requirements. So this is, you know, recognized now as key to risk management and credit support. So that's another thing to include in legislation, that they have the authority to structure their own book of wholesale contracts. I think joint powers authority, you know, some states have that already, some states don't. but the ability to form a separate entity that is still a, you know, a government agency, but you get a group of like-minded municipalities together, you hammer out your goals and objectives for the agency, you draft the governance structure of it, and then you adopt that, and suddenly you have a much larger CCA that is meeting regularly to discuss issues of planning and operations, right? Hiring their own staff and building out their operating model. And that kind of forms the core of being able to essentially teach as many people as possible about how the energy sector works or doesn't work well in practice, right? So that's another key feature, I would say. Rick, do you have anything to add?
I mean, mine are much more mundane, and I apologize if the background noise is too bad, I'll go on mute. But two things I would mention is, in the enabling legislation, try to get a restriction on the incumbent IOUs' ability to use ratepayer funds to try to market or kill off, I guess would be the best way of putting it, an emerging CCA. And the second is to allow for an opt-out model where once the CCA forms, all customers are enrolled and people only, you know, their only choice is to opt out. Those are, I guess, a little more mundane, a little more political, but I wouldn't forget those features.
So the default provider clause is an important one. Because, you know, especially in urban environments, you have a number of renters moving in and out. And so you want those customers to be automatically put onto the CCA's service on an opt-out basis. So you still send them opt-out mailers, but you know, the CCA is the default provider. Regarding the utility relationship, it's kind of funny, Rick. You know, in other states, it's not nearly as severe. but, you know, that depends on local, you know, the local context and the political culture. So it's certainly something to pay attention to. My view is that,
Go ahead, Sam.
My view is that, if utilities understand that we are on a long-term decarbonization trend, and it's going to require a much more flexible response and a lot more infrastructure development than they're used to, then they might actually be quite happy about having energy experts on staff who they can work with at the local level. Because a lot of this activity, particularly around, you know, microgrids, transportation corridors, electric vehicle charging networks, distributed energy acceleration. A lot of that takes place at the local level, obviously. And so utilities are in a bit of a bind because they're under a governance structure that evolved for the precise opposite system, right? Centralized business, like, this actually fixes a really big problem for utility executives who are looking at this and saying, you know, we have a very clumsy set of rules that for some reason we need to follow that are going to be increasingly in conflict with, you know, the political pressure to do something about all this. So it's kind of, I've been talking about this as the third leg of the stool. You know, we, as an industry, we focus on technology and business models, but that third leg is governance, and pretty much everywhere needs a game plan for that.
You know, I was going to mention that one of the questions I have is, I don't think that we have some of the problems that you do in California because we're fully deregulated, so there's no exit fees, there's we're not cutting into any part of the core business of the IOUs, but they have a pretty good sized staff. I have a directory of at least one of the utilities' energy efficiency staff, which is put together to follow the mandates put forward by the state of Connecticut. And I do wonder about whether they will look at the possible CCA takeover, in my dreams, of energy efficiency programs as a threat or an opportunity, a boon, you know, sort of what you were saying, Samuel, about that. On the one hand, I have a hard time believing it's a big profit center for them because of the, you know, way that they really make money through the return on their infrastructure. But they may actually look at it as a pain in the neck. But I don't really know. I don't think we'll know until we start introducing legislation.
Yeah. So one of the relevant dynamics there is that, at least in California, the utilities who have controlled efficiency programs haven't done a good job in using those investments to avoid the need to invest in infrastructure. So there's kind of an obvious business model conflict there. The way that efficiency programs run by utilities typically work is that regulators set performance targets for, you know, amount of rebates spent or savings achieved by various metrics. But they're not, you know, that's all well and good, but you could, you know, deploy a lot of smart thermostats and insulation upgrades in a particular region and avoid the need to upgrade or delay the need to upgrade, you know, a $40 million, you know, set of transformers or, you know, a substation, right? So that's an example of what I refer to as co-optimization and the way that the industry has been siloed. Everyone's gotten used to thinking about all these initiatives as somehow separate from one another instead of intimately linked, because actually it's the same system, right? It's just a different segment of it. So you might run into some political friction there.
Let me just expand that a little bit. We do have a proceeding at the California Public Utilities Commission that would promote a different kind of business model where you could, in fact, use distributed energy resources, distributed generation, batteries, et cetera, as a alternative for, you know, distribution upgrades, and where ultimately the IOUs could recover or gain some profit from using those non-wire alternative methods. But as Samuel has pointed out, and as you mentioned, Peter, there is an ultimate, you know, conflict there in that the total capital expenditure under those models is going to be less than the traditional approach. And so, you know, long term, the interesting piece that Samuel raises is the long term use of non-wire alternatives going to require such a large amount of, you know, new infrastructure that it replaces what was traditionally done under the, you know, the centralized model. And so they do end up, you know, being made whole, so to speak, in terms of those profit margins. That's a big what if. Right now the dynamic is, you know, one of the utilities is a little bit more progressive, but two of them are, you know, you talk about lots of staff, they got lots of lawyers arguing and delaying these kinds of initiatives. So this is broader than the CCA question. But the point is that the CCAs are uniquely positioned to become aggregators of distributed energy resources through customer programs to provide those distribution system and potentially even transmission system infrastructure costs.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Sam.
Well, one of the effective talking points for utility executives I've found is that, you know, remind them that they are entering into a period when a lot of people are going to start really understanding their business outside of their business. And they're not used to that, by the way, right? This was pretty much a backwater for 100 years.
This is really important. Now this is a really, I want to just reinforce what you just said, Sam. It's a really important point because it is the fundamental, you know, cultural dynamic here.
Yeah, and so it has a really important corollary impact on how they approach investments, because utilities can actually have costs disallowed even after they've been approved. They can be disallowed at any point if regulators or if the legislature makes the determination that those investments were the wrong ones to make, and they were made in the interest of shareholders instead of the public, because the entire compact of guaranteed rates of return for a private monopoly is based on this one thing. They have to make investments in the public's interest and not put their shareholders' interests ahead of the public. And that's not really well known, because, again, For so long, nobody has understood this business. It's very rare to have costs disallowed. But, you know, so in this case, yeah, you could run efficiency programs and you could run them, you know, and meet metrics, but you could have been running them to avoid infrastructure costs. Those costs, that new rate base that you're so happy about this year, in 5 years, that might blow back on you in a major way. And so a lot of utilities are starting to understand this. I think it's one of the drivers behind the cultural shift that we're seeing. They're facing a period of risk on their rate-based investments that, you know, is unprecedented going forward.
So
Peter, we lost you.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
We're good.
Okay. So just so that I understand, you're saying that utilities may wake up, or they are waking up to the notion that energy efficiency programs will, particularly if they're done well and if they're focused, targeted, they can help avoid infrastructure investment, but that infrastructure investment is part of what will make for a healthy company, a healthy utility, because that's how it makes its money, return on infrastructure. Is that a too simple?
It's a little. There's this one part of utility finance, and I'm not an expert in this, by the way, so I'm just going to go out on a limb and say this. But a lot of our industry is defined by kind of cultural and intellectual inertia, in that the same things just get repeated over and over until it becomes kind of common wisdom. And sometimes it's not true. And so when I think about utility stock prices, it does occur to me that, you know, their current shareholders, so whenever the utility makes an investment, right, it requires equity and debt, right? And that goes into the rate base, and then it gets repaid over a period of time at a guaranteed rate of return. So their current shareholders' financial interests are actually tied to the existing infrastructure and the risk that infrastructure will be disallowed at some point in the future. When the utility adds new infrastructure, it requires new debt and equity, right? And so it impacts existing shareholders in two ways, right? It's good for them if the rate of return on that new infrastructure is higher than the old infrastructure. and conversely hurts them if it's lower for some reason, right? Because it all gets put into, they don't differentiate paying shareholders back by tranches of investment over time. It's all one rate base. And the other way that it impacts it is if that infrastructure has a higher risk of being disallowed in future, it can harm all shareholders at that point. So I think there might be a kind of misperception or might even be a misalignment with the way executives are compensated, where they're being incentivized to build rate base when they really should be focused on lowering the risk of disallowance going forward and maintaining their expected rate of return on the current installed infrastructure, if that makes sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense, Samuel. Let me make this concrete for people in terms of your question, Peter. In 2017, PG&E, the sort of largest IOU in California, canceled a $143 million transmission infrastructure project that would have served an area known as the Fresno area. The reasons that they gave, and they put it up on a website, and then they took it down 2 weeks later because they didn't want it to be public, but it did get out to the public. The reasons they gave were the growth of distributed energy resources in the Fresno area. In other words, the development of both energy efficiency, but in this particular case, behind-the-meter customer solar, had so reduced the need for that transmission infrastructure that it no longer made sense. So they did do what Samuel is talking about, which is recognizing they couldn't justify that transmission project anymore. Now, those DERs, those solar projects, was about 50 megawatts. Half of those were at school districts where my company helped those school districts put those systems in over a 2-3 year period. And one of my school superintendents, when he saw in the newspaper this dynamic, he said to me, so am I going to get a piece of that savings, that $143 million? I mean, I'm right. And yep. I share this story because, in that particular case, those solar projects, and now we put in some batteries with those schools, were not built to do distribution deferral. They were not installed. The economic modeling was not to do distribution deferral. It just so happened that was a byproduct. The world that we're trying to create here is one where decisions about these kinds of projects do, in fact, take into account that distribution deferral component. And the risk model that Samuel's talking about is really, I never thought about this way, Samuel. This is fascinating. We now are in a time where a utility executive has to look at an investment and say, is there currently a non-wire alternative, one of these DER models, that actually could compete effectively in terms of ratepayer benefit, right, that, on that metric, such that I better be careful about how I structure my investments, because 5 years from now, somebody could come back and take that money away from me because I didn't consider this alternative of supporting this alternative through incentive programs, rate designs, whatever. I just want to make it a little more concrete with this example.
That I have to say
that's a great example.
I sort of was following it, but that example makes it concrete exactly as you say.
Great.
Yep.
And that's a good example of how siloed the industry is still. Even at the highest levels, like power flow and transmission planning, they do not do a good job of capturing all the impacts across the whole system from these technological changes and these market-driven DER deployments. And as a consequence...
The irony is, it was PG&E who approved and oversaw those interconnections of those DERs. So the silos aren't just between the utility and others. It's even within the utility themselves. The people who are doing those interconnections and their process and their data being shared with the transmission and distribution group, right? They don't talk to each other.
I want to tee off this to kind of socialize the understanding that, like, we really have to fix governance and collapse all the silos here that have been hard-coded over this last century for not only because it would accelerate decarbonization, but it's actually a necessity from like a reliability point of view. Because we have built out so many renewables and we are changing how customers consume electricity, the patterns, so rapidly that it is stressing the current system. And so if you're not forecasting accurately, if you're not optimizing things accurately, or you have no ability to track and manage all these, you know, the three nuclear power plants worth of distributed energy that California has deployed, it can get you into trouble. And here's a great example. Prices have been spiking in Southern California, which has been driving up prices around the whole WEC. And actually, it's put the entire Western grid into a, what's called an N11 contingency, which is a reliability crisis. And it's not actually because of renewables. It's because the utilities, both the gas and the power utilities and the regulator, and even WEC, they did not properly understand the interplay between the natural gas and the electricity systems. And this became very apparent when Aliso Canyon, which
Aliso
is a
Canyon.
So this is a natural gas storage facility. It's absolutely massive. It is half of the storage in LA Basin, which is it's a constrained zone. So we have a limited number of transmission lines and a limited number of gas pipelines coming into this geography. And we have to have, you know, quite a lot of power, actually, because it's L.A., which is like 50 cities bound together. And so they, you know, that facility developed a leak, and it's been physically secure for 19 months, right? We've known it's safe. But it caused such a scandal that the regulators have restricted its operations. So you can only withdraw gas if the power grid is going to go down. The problem there is that it created liquidity shortages and gaming opportunities for gas marketers in LA Basin. And so our power plants there are being priced really high. And so when that happens, the grid operator turns on less efficient power plants up in Northern California or even in the balancing areas around the West and imports as much power as possible down to LA. So it's been this huge price contagion. And the irony there, I mean, it's a really big deal. It's probably transferred $2 billion worth of wealth from our customers to less efficient power plants and gas suppliers. It's kind of a mini energy crisis. The irony there is that the duck curve, which everyone complains about, right, the midday output of solar, that, you know, there's a sense now with certain experts that they think that that actually saved Los Angeles from being hit by multiple rolling blackouts already, because it took out the gas burn from the midday peakers on that network. And so this is the thing. If we're going to change all of these dynamics, we better make damn sure that
we have
the analytical infrastructure in place to understand what we're doing and to see two steps ahead. Everything needs to be updated, and it's just not being updated by the current industry. It actually needs to be disrupted by, you know, technical.
Well, it's not just the industry. It's not just the industry. Hmm. The regulatory body in this case, the CPUC, is totally clueless. I mean, they really are clueless about these.
Oh, that's and, I include and, them in and, the industry. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the government.
They are the
yeah,
industry.
That's why. Yeah.
And
they actually
they
settle
clueless.
The rules.
They actually look at net metering and the emergence of CCAs as more of a risk than an opportunity. And they have been promulgating policies to restrict and restrain the growth of distributed generation and the growth of CCAs, because they're still looking at it through, as Sam just said, the lens from 15 years ago.
Hey, guys, I actually have to jump to a call with the chair of the California Energy Commission. So I'm going to have to jump off. But really appreciate, Samuel, your comments here. You've blown up my head. I never had thought about that risk dynamic that you talked about for utility executives. That's really that changes my whole – changes everything. Really good
insight. Well,
thank you, guys.
There's one word of caution. I'm not an expert in that, so tell me what you find out.
No. From an organizational –
Great to meet you,
Rick. My background is in organizational psychology, so it actually filled in a gap that I had in my model about the behavioral dynamics in the industry that I wasn't aware of.
Oh, nice.
So
good.
Good stuff.
One thing before everybody disappears, Samuel will actually be giving a webinar on July 23rd, which is a little ways off, but this is the next webinar. We're not doing one in June. And then we also have two conference calls coming up. One is Jerry Braun on June 25th talking about the analysis that he's done of non-energy benefits of local resource development. And also on June 27th, Larissa Dobrianska has done a lot of research and thinking about advanced microgrids. So she'll be giving a presentation on that too, obviously followed by open discussion. So I hope to see you all then. And any other comments before we leave here? And Craig,
I see you
just arrived.
Thank you, Samuel. I learned a lot. I'm really glad I was asked to participate.
You're my pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
And Samuel, do you have a second we can actually talk?
Yeah, do you want to call me back afterwards?
I will do that. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. All right.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
See you next
Thank
time.
Thank you.
All right now. Yep. Bye.